Beyond the debate about capital punishment in this country is the reality of the methods we use. From 1924 through 1999, for over 75 years, the gas chamber has been a part of that dreadful reality. What is the history of this method of execution that was for so long the norm here in California? And what is the connection, both morally and corporately, between our use in America of the gas chamber and the spreading of the gas chamber throughout the world in the First and Second World War? We're going to talk about this morning with my guest, Scott Christensen. He's a writer, an investigative reporter, and historian. He's the author of the previously acclaimed book, With Liberty for Some, 500 Years of Imprisonment in America. It is my pleasure to have him here to talk about his newest work, The Last Gasp, The Rise and Fall of the American Gas Chamber. Scott Christensen, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure to be with you. Thanks.
Great to have you here. Talk first about how the gas chamber came to be initially in 1924.
Well, it's hard to really imagine, but the gas chamber, I think, originated as a utopian idea. There were many people, including many progressives, who in the late 19th century thought, gee, wouldn't it be nice if we could rid society of the unfit, who were such a burden upon us, the elderly, the infirm, the mentally diseased and disordered, and others. So a number of people, ranging from H.G. Wells to D.H. Lawrence and many others, had these kinds of notions as part of their belief in eugenics. And they had envisioned something they called the lethal chamber. It was really just an idea. But over time, this idea gradually became a reality.
As that reality came to be, talk about the first gas chamber, the first patent for this.
Well, following World War I and the tremendous experience of chemical warfare that enveloped the world and in which the United States played such a prominent role, there had been a great deal of research on poisons of all sorts. And some of these poisons were used in chemical warfare, and some of them were adapted for various constructive peacetime uses, such as pesticides, for many other types of uses. And agencies of the United States government, including the Chemical Warfare Service, the Public Health Service, and others, encouraged the use of various kinds of poisons, particularly cyanide. Cyanide gas was used to carry out the first execution in a gas chamber, a specially constructed apparatus into which hydrogen cyanide gas was pumped. That occurred in February of 1924 in the Nevada State Penitentiary, involving a Chinese immigrant named Gui Zhan, who had been convicted of murder. And he was killed by that method, becoming the first person in the world to be executed by lethal gas.
There was also this sense of wanting this chamber to provide a kind of insulation from the public and witnesses, to sanitize it in some way.
There was this notion of humane killing, of humane death. Animals were, by the hundreds of thousands, were being euthanized, stray animals and worn out horses and such. By various methods, and it was thought that a form of euthanasia of sorts could be used against human beings. Initially, this was done through the execution process involving convicted criminals, and part of the whole thing that the state dealt with at that time was not only how to carry it out technically, but how should the public be separated from this rather dangerous process, because poison gas could prove dangerous to not only the staff but to witnesses. And yet, while protecting them, while safeguarding them as they witnessed this, and it was necessary for somebody to witness it to assure the public that this was being carried out, there was an effort to try to create some sort of peephole or a window or ability for outsiders to gaze into this killing that was going on. Mm-hmm. And so this was another feature that was built into the gas chamber in the United States.
What about the military and their fascination with this?
Well, the military were very interested in the manner of death, how to defend against a poison gas attack. It was thought, based on the experience of World War One, that the war of the future was going to be a chemical war. And they were extremely interested in death by poison gases of all sorts. And here was an opportunity for them to actually observe and to help carry out the killing of a human being. And so they did express a very keen interest and participated in some ways in the process of execution. There was a company based in Denver, Colorado, the Eaton Metal Products Company, which built gas tanks and other grain bins and large steel receptacles made of specially treated steel. And this company began to manufacture specially designed gas chambers that looked sort of like a space capsule or a diving bell, which were very carefully contained to prevent any kind of accident. And this company actually patented the idea of the gas chamber in the 1930s, in the late 1930s, in several states in the United States, eight to be exact. Gas chambers were erected. They were erected in Colorado, Arizona, California, of course, North Carolina, a number of states. And there was a wave of gas chamber construction that went on. And it was thought that this manner of death would replace hanging, would replace the electric chair, and it would amount to a humane form of killing. But as it turned out, that wouldn't be so.
What was the aspect of it that was considered humane vis-a-vis hanging and execution?
Well, first of all, we have to realize that prior to about 1900 in the United States, the main method of execution of criminals or alleged criminals was by lynching. And lynchings were very numerous throughout the United States, particularly the South and in the West. It was a very horrible and grisly process that involved not only hanging, but mutilation. And it amounted to a mass spectacle in many instances. Somebody would be dragged out of the jail and subjected to all kinds of tortures and then finally killed. And when the state took over the hanging process and began to carry out hangings inside penal institutions, trying to control this public lust for blood, it imposed various restrictions and tried to control the process, but it still proved to be a rather grisly form of execution. And in some instances, heads came off in the process and other horrible things happened. There was prolonged agony on the part of the doomed person. The electric chair was invented in the late 19th century in New York, and that was instituted in a number of states. It appeared to be very quick, but it also produced very distasteful kinds of results in terms of burning of bodies and such. And so gas seemed to be something that would kill quickly, would not mutilate the body of the condemned. It would be like putting somebody to sleep, it was thought, and it would not be painful, and it would be a quick and humane form of killing that would pass muster with the courts and not amount to cruel and unusual punishment. But as time went on, people began to see that actually these deaths were more protracted and more problematic, more painful than had been expected.
How was it perceived in other parts of the world?
Well, that's a very good question because, of course, we have the terrible reality of the Holocaust occurring in the immediate aftermath of this wave of gas chamber construction in the United States, when many states, including California, were proclaiming that this was a humane form of killing, that there was no suffering or pain involved, and that this was being done in a very scientific manner, was sparing the public the distasteful view of the person suffering, and on and on and on. And people in some parts of the world were horrified by that this was going on. They didn't really want to see any form of capital punishment. But there were others who viewed it and certainly were pondering what would happen in their own country if it were used. Trotsky commented on it, said that this was an example of the barbarism of the capitalist system, and that this would be used on a very large scale against masses of people in the future. He said that in the 30s. And I believe that it was more than coincidental that at the very time that Adolf Hitler was writing Mein Kampf, while imprisoned in Germany, the execution was going on. It was being reported from Nevada, and he was receiving news reports about it. And as he was formulating some of his philosophy, including some of his genocidal notions, this began to captivate his imagination. He became familiar with the notion of the gas chamber. And eventually, beginning in about 1940, when the Nazis began to wage war against the world, they, of course, began to institute gas chambers on a massive scale, on an industrial scale. And they recognized that it really offered the best opportunity for mass execution. It was the most efficient manner of mass killing that they had devised. So it had an enormous impact. Millions of people were affected, were killed in the gas chambers in prisons throughout Europe. And as a result of the growing realization and revulsion on the part of the world that this had occurred, over the years, in the aftermath of World War II, there was a very deep revulsion on the part of most of the civilized world. And this affected views about the death penalty generally. Most countries ended the death penalty. In the United States, it began to fall in increasing disfavor, and the notion of lethal gas also really went under a cloud, so to speak. So it had an enormous effect. And eventually, in 1960, there was the very famous execution of Carol Chessman in California, which gave further attention to the manner of death and the nature of lethal gassing, and occurred at about the same time as the trial of Adolf Eichmann for his crimes in the Nazi death camps. And so this had an enormous effect on the psyche of the American public. And I believe it contributed in large measure to the moratorium on capital punishment that began in the early 60s and really took hold in the late 60s and continued through the late 70s, when there were no executions being carried out by any method in the United States.
And yet the remarkable thing is that with the worldwide revulsion to the use of gas immediately after World War II, that this was still a method that went on pretty extensively in California right on up through the final use in 1999.
It was something that certainly got attention. Ronald Reagan, while he was governor of California, had to deal with this horrible spectacle of gassing that was still being carried out from time to time in California. And he, I believe, began to see that problematic. And when the moratorium was established, and he and other conservatives wanted to bring back capital punishment, it was Ronald Reagan who suggested that another method be substituted to replace gas. And he specifically called for the use of injections, saying that, you know, this was something that was used for horses to put them to sleep, and it seemed to be a good method for horses, and we ought to try it out on people. He didn't mention at the time that it had been used on a very large scale by the Nazis to kill many, many thousands of people, and that this method of lethal injection was something that had already been tried and used very extensively in prisons in Europe. But ultimately, it was in large measure accepted as the predominant replacement for not only lethal gas, but the electric chair. And the former gas chambers were converted to lethal injection chambers. And now we see gurneys in there and people being executed by poison injection rather than the asphyxiation from lethal gas.
Talk a little bit about what you unearthed with regard to the production of this hydrogen cyanide gas during the World War II period.
Well, this is a very, very complicated story. I didn't realize how complicated it would be. But in trying to track down who was manufacturing the cyanide, what was the extent of the cyanide industry in the world, and such, I began to see that this was a very, very big business. There was a cyanide cartel that existed in which the German conglomerate IG Farben was very much involved. But also there were a number of other large corporations that were involved, including American Cyanamid in Canada and the United States, DuPont Chemical based in Delaware in the United States, Imperial Chemical Industries in Great Britain. They were all involved in a cartel. They were fixing prices. They were doing business together. And some of these corporations who were in league with IG Farben, such as American Cyanamid, were inventing various processes for the use of a new form of hydrogen cyanide called Zyklon B. This was ultimately the form of gas that was used in the with greatest effectiveness in the Nazi gas chambers at Auschwitz. And I found that the cartel continued to maintain channels of communication and to remain in business in Switzerland during World War II. And it was back to business as usual when the war was over, not to produce a poison gas for the slaughter of millions of people in gas chambers, but for other purposes such as pesticides, for example. And so most of these corporations are still in existence. They're still operating, but this part of their history hasn't really come out. California played a particularly significant role in this development of the use of various forms of cyanide. There were Germans who came to California and were involved in the fumigation of the fruit fields and other crops in California, and they were trying out different methods of the use of cyanide, and they took some of this back to Germany, and there were various corporations housed in Los Angeles and other California cities that contributed to this development of cyanide production and use. So it's a very, very rich and chilling history, I believe.
Another aspect of the history that is equally chilling is the relationship between the use of gas, you touched on this a little bit earlier, and the whole business of eugenics.
Absolutely. today, I think most people have absolutely no recollection or any idea. They can't really imagine the power of these eugenics ideas that were so rampant at the early part of the 20th century. It was thought by many people that we could use various scientific methods to measure a person's intelligence and other qualities, and to essentially identify who were the inferior stock and who were the superior stock. And of course, much of this was carried out in a very biased way and assumed racial lines. And there was the notion that we could actually commit mass sterilization against certain groups that we did not want to propagate. And involuntary sterilization was used on a very large scale in the United States and in parts of Europe in the 20s and 30s. And there was very open talk by many leading scientific and medical people, some of them had won Nobel Prizes, saying that, gee, this gas chamber offers a great opportunity for us to rid society of these defectives. And, of course, this was actually something that was put into practice by Hitler under the guise of euthanasia to commit mass murder against whole races and classes of people. And it was actually put into practice, but it was being suggested in the United States, it was being suggested in Britain, being suggested in Germany for many years prior to it actually being carried out in Germany.
And talk a little bit about the degree to which the gas chamber and the revulsion to it over time really played a significant role in our overall view of capital punishment in this country.
I think it did. I think that there certainly was a realization that developed more gradually than I think most of us appreciate today, following the Holocaust. It didn't immediately take effect, but after the Nuremberg trials and many other disclosures that continued into the 1960s, it became more and more apparent that these gas chambers that had been used by the Nazis were absolutely horrific. There was tremendous pain and suffering involved, and there was more attention given to the actual manner of death in the American gas chambers as well, and more scientific input occurred, and people began to see that death was more protracted than had been expected, and this was developed by a number of lawyers based in California to challenge the use of lethal gas on a constitutional basis. This was done in the 1990s. And finally, in 1994, a federal district court judge in San Francisco was convinced, based on an overwhelming cascade of evidence that was presented in the court, that indeed death by lethal gas was not painless, was not instantaneous, did amount to cruel and unusual punishment. This ruling was upheld, and so there was a recognition on the part of the federal courts that at least that method of execution was no longer acceptable. By a quirk, there was a case in Arizona in 1999, which was the final execution by lethal gas in the United States and in the world, and ironically it involved a German national who was also an American in the state of Arizona, and he was put to death by lethal gas, having chosen that method over lethal injection. So this was a method of execution that went on for 75 years in the United States.
And California seemed to lead the charge in terms of the number of these executions.
California and North Carolina were really vying for the number one spot. And North Carolina had come to it a little sooner, but they cooled on it before California. And California continued to use it. It was a more populous state. And they did use it, and it became really heavily identified with California because of a number of famous Hollywood films and books, and of course the Chessman case. And so people really began to see through a number of these films, which appeared to be almost documentary films, really very authentic recreations of the manner of killing of the gas chamber in California. People began to see what a horrific thing it was.
Why do you think that California led the way in this regard? I mean, given a state with somewhat, during this period, of a progressive tradition, why was California so determined to keep doing this?
It's hard for me to really say that with complete authority, but I think that there were a number of interests in California, not only interests that focused on capital punishment, and which still focus on capital punishment and imprisonment, but there were, of course, the chemical industry, the production of pesticides, and the industrial uses of some of these poisons created certain vested interests and support for this kind of thing. We like to think that we as Americans, and I'm sure that many people in California like to believe that we are a good and fair and kind people, but we don't really recognize that we are among the most punitive group of citizens in the world. And California, of course, has a tremendous number of people in prison today. Its prison system really dwarfs that of most countries in the world, and it is a rather punitive state, we have a very punitive country here in the United States, and we like to believe otherwise, but unfortunately that is the case. Just as we're involved in a lot of wars, we're involved in a lot of punishment at home.
Scott Christensen. His book is The Last Gasp, The Rise and Fall of the American Gas Chamber. It's just out from University of California Press. Scott, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.